Astronomy Cast, episode 637, Machine Learning in Astronomy. Welcome to Astronomy Cast, our weekly facts-based journey through the cosmos, where we help you understand not only what we know, but how we know what we know. I'm Fraser Cain, publisher of Universe Today, and with me, as always, Dr. Pamela Gay, a senior scientist for the Planetary Science Institute and the director of CosmoQuest. Hey, Pamela, how are you doing?
I am doing well. I have given in to presbyopia, and I have gotten glasses, and yeah. As someone put it, the trees, they now have leaves.
I'm ready. It's my time as well. I think I can, you know, there's only so far my arms will let me, you know, stretch my phone away from my face. Yeah. Getting old sucks.
But presbyopia is such a cool word. So if you're going to have something go wrong, may it at least have a really cool word to describe it.
Right. Yeah. If only all medical and I guess age conditions were like that.
Yeah.
Computers are a big part of astronomy, but mostly they've been relegated to doing calculations. But recent developments in machine learning have changed everything, giving computers the ability to do jobs that humans could only do in the past. I guess it's not that surprising that computers, machine learning specifically, are starting to show up across the field of astronomy. Computers have been tied in so closely to everything that astronomers do that it's just a matter of time before the artificial intelligence shows up to really run things.
Well, and it's getting to the point where the rate at which we're acquiring data is growing exponentially.
Yeah.
And the number of astronomers in the field is not growing. And so since we don't have more astronomers to deal with all of the data, we've really got three choices. Students, again, not enough of them. The general public, and we do totally use the general public. Go listen to one of our episodes on citizen science. But again, not enough of them because exponential growth. And this is where we have to turn to computers and hope that processing speeds continue to grow at a rate that allows us to keep up with that flux of data.
Now, it's funny, you are uniquely positioned to talk about this situation because you have been at the forefront of citizen science, of identifying things that computers can't do that humans can do and are happy to do or will begrudgingly do if you let them know that the science is important and Bennu's rocks really do need to be mapped.
But
Bennu rocks. But just this idea that there's things that computers are really bad at. And so let's organize a whole bunch of human beings to do the things that humans can still do that computers can't do. Is that landscape starting to change from your perspective?
It's changing in terms of how we are interfacing with volunteers. Once upon a time, back in the days that the Galaxy Zoo Project entered the battlefield of human versus data set, there was an issue where the Sloan Digital Sky Survey had so many tens of thousands of hundreds of thousands of galaxies in it that there was no way poor Kevin Shvinsky was going to, as part of his dissertation, get through hand marking all of the galaxies without madness occurring.
Right. It was a job for grad students, but still, there weren't enough of those.
And at that point in time, software was nowhere near being capable of being trained to mark galaxies. This was about the point that one of my colleagues, when she was working on her dissertation back in the days of MySpace and LiveJournal, posted something along the lines of, my software has discovered that wherever there are lizards, there are sailboats, except sometimes they're mountains. Because the training set for the software, it turned out, where they were marking lizard, 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 the training set, all the triangles in the training set were sailboats. Except when they got to other data sets, there were triangles that were mountains. And so we don't always know what we have used to train our machine learning algorithms, and they can make fabulous mistakes. Wolves are dogs that have snow around them, came the results of one algorithm.
Right.
And so at that point in time, we couldn't get software to say, this is a galaxy and this is what the galaxy is doing. Now, luckily, with the advent of better and better processing, and more importantly, the advent of cloud computing, we are able to spin up special systems that are designed to learn better, faster, not cheaper. Yeah, they're so expensive, but better and faster by taking the training sets from human beings and saying, okay, based on this, I actually now have the capacity to figure out what galaxies are. So now, instead of having strictly the human being saying this is a galaxy that is behaving in this way, the software goes through and goes, this one is shaped like this, this one is shaped like this, this one, low probability on my understanding it, kick it back to the humans. So the humans are now the trainers and the fixers. And this frees up the humans to work on solving more and more problems. And this is useful because there are some problems like we had with Bennu, where the entire data set that you need to classify to, in this case, find a safe place for OSIRIS-REx to boop an asteroid, the entire data set wasn't big enough to train an algorithm. So the humans had to do the entire thing. But when the data set is big enough, now the humans just train it and then fix its mistakes.
So let's talk about, like, fundamentally how, I guess, how machine learning works, and then sort of how it's used in astronomy.
Machine learning is very much a black box. Even the people who do machine learning, although some of the latest articles are hinting at new ways to look in at what the computers are making their choices off of. But the basic idea is there are algorithms that when you show them an image that has the thing that you are interested in the image, so you have to divide things up into stamps for the software still. So you divide it up, and the software then looks at your image and says, based on the 10,000 to a million images like this that I've looked at, I am going to, say it's doing facial recognition on a human, look at the separation of the eyes, the eye to chin ratio, and look at all these different things and identify who is in the image, what is in the image. And the places where we still run into trouble, and machine learning gets used for many other things. I'm focused very, very narrowly on computer vision right now. Where the software still struggles is we can't just give it a mosaic of the moon and say, go forth and find all the craters. We have to instead identify all of the craters through some other means. And then once the craters are identified, try and get software that will correctly identify the edges of the craters. And we can still only get that at the 90-something percent accuracy level, which isn't good enough for a lot of what we'd like to do.
Yeah, and like underlying, like the way these algorithms work, and I mean, you know, there are whole podcasts that go into how machine learning algorithms work. But generally, you've got a neural network, and again, that's a whole other conversation, that you are teaching it how to do various things. And so you show it a picture and you say, this is a crater. And then you show it another picture and go, this is a crater. And then you show it a million more and go, these are craters. And that's sort of one part to it. And then the other part that sort of has really kind of taken off is this idea of an adversarial network.
Yeah.
So you have one computer whose job is to is to recognize craters, and then another computer whose job is to tell whether or not the first computer is doing a good job of recognizing craters. And so one is good at generating something and the other one is good at recognizing something. You can set those two against each other, and that's how you get those, like, you know, human faces generated by artificial intelligence with these generative adversarial networks. But just in general, it's this process. And as you say, it can be, if you're lucky, it can be automated, but it's almost never, you're never lucky. And it's always a human being is patiently explaining to a computer, this is a crater. This is not a crater. This is a crater. Do you see the crater over here, computer? This is a crater. So so humans are deeply involved in this process.
And the reason that craters are something that it struggles with so incredibly much is because soils can be completely different colors from one place to another. You can have varying shadows, and the soil can be different textures. And computer vision has to be given a training set as diverse as the population it's eventually going to be working on. Twitter ran into severe problems with their image algorithm, where if you give Twitter too large of an image in one aspect ratio or another, it's going to only show the person in your Twitter feed a section of that image. And they have a really good algorithm for figuring out where the face of a white person is.
Right. Yeah.
And it's not so,
so it's garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah. And yeah. And so we have to be cognizant of good data sets in. So to return to the lunar problem, if you go through and you do an excellent job marking every crater in an Apollo region, well, it's either going to all be mare or all be regolith, which means it's all going to be dark soil or light soil. And that algorithm's only going to be able to work on that particular kind of the moon. Right. During that particular lighting condition. So getting a diverse enough training sample can be hard for some problems.
Yeah.
Other problems, it's super easy.
It's funny, that concept of like having a difficult time also changes even if you just change the parameters. Like if you take a picture of a dog and you rotate it 90 degrees, so now it's a dog on its side, the computer just goes like, I don't know what I'm looking at here.
Right.
What is this? Where's the dog? There's no dogs in this picture. And then you rotate it back and like, oh, there's the dog. I see it. But those kinds of sort of image translations are being done now as rudimentary part of this machine learning. So they're getting better and better. All of these issues that we're talking about are getting better and better and better. And I think, you know, the reason we queued up this episode, this topic, is because I don't know how it feels to you, but it feels to me like we are shifting into from them being more of a pain than they are a help, and us really wanting to have humans do the work, to us shifting into this hybrid model where they're pretty good when you've got humans that know what they're doing to train them. And now we're getting some really amazing results out of these machine learning projects.
And it's that combination of they're finally giving us really good results. And with LSST coming, it's kind of like machine learning is our Obi-Wan Kenobi. It is our final hope.
Yeah.
And the diversity of problems that are being approached with it, we have not just the galaxies and the still doesn't work correctly craters, but we also have things like looking at light curves and finding exoplanets. We have figuring out comets and asteroids as transient phenomena, identifying supernovae, space weather. We have this amazing suite of solar observatories coming online and online right now. And solar storms, as some of you in the past week have been able to see, generate amazing light shows in our sky that can also do really bad things to our power grid and satellites in orbit. Right. And machine learning is helping us understand that space weather.
Yeah, we had the auroras here last night. It was, but they were hidden behind cloud. And so we could see the green glow peeking through the clouds in purple and stuff around it. Yeah, it was rough. So let's talk about this idea. So you gave a great example, this idea of, say, exoplanets, of recognizing exoplanets. And so having a human being look at a light curve, having, you know, we've always said that we can teach a four-year-old how to recognize a crater, right?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's really hard to get a four-year-old to recognize the light curve of an exoplanet. So how, for example, has machine learning been able to really make an impact on that kind of a research?
The human eye is troubled by noise and can both see false signals in noise and also miss actual signals in the noise. So say you have data coming down from a star that has sunspots on it, other things that may be causing noise in its particular light, but it also has a planet that's going around and around within that noise. Well, the computer will have the ability to see there is always this exact same looking dip over time that is repeating over and over at the exact same interval that, while it may not be that different from the noise, it's always there, and that's a planet. It also just relieves all of the people who otherwise could be doing other science from having to look at data that isn't perfectly clean. Classic algorithms were completely fine going, the star is constant brightness, it dipped X percent and then became constant brightness. Yeah. Classic algorithms, I could write that code in 2 days. To deal with messier systems, to deal with multiple planets, to deal with noise, you needed humans, and they were still imperfect, and the algorithms are still imperfect. But between both of them, we're going to find everything.
Now, you sort of introed into this video just talking about the enormous amounts of data that are coming online, and it's really hard to understate how significant this modern age of astronomy, these giant observatories connected with huge fiber optic cables to the internet and will just be disgorging their data onto the internet by the exabyte. Like the Vera Rubin telescope?
Yeah. It's Vera Rubin Observatory doing the LSST, which is the name of the survey. And so I can still say LSST. It will always be LSST. So LSST is going to be returning petabytes of data per day. It's like Cisco Systems is designing special systems for this scope.
Yeah.
And they are expecting, they're not entirely sure of the order of magnitude, but between tens of thousands and millions of transient phenomena. These are things that flicker, flare, pulse, move, or otherwise are not constant in the data set. And that's going to be comets, asteroids, which were one of the major motivations for building this scope, supernovae, BLAC objects, which are galaxies that flicker in brightness, regular pulsating stars, cataclysmic variables.
Planet Nine.
Planet Nine is my deepest hope. I need that world to exist. That world. And with a machine learning algorithm, we can feed the system, okay, here are 100,000 objects that we already know about, that we have tortured people with the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, with the Dark Energy Survey, with all the precursor surveys. Here, computer, is what these known objects look like.
Yeah, in terms of like spectroscopic information, in terms of visual information, in terms of time domain, how they move, how they change in brightness, all that kind of information. Thanks, humans.
And then one of the nice things about looking at the sky as opposed to looking at the surface of a planet is we've had for decades algorithms that go through and say, light, no light, light, no light. And can look at the distribution of the light, and all stars are point sources. And their light is smeared out in a way that is dictated by the optics and, if you're using a planetary scope, by the atmosphere. All the stars will have the exact same shape on your image. And anything that doesn't have that shape, that's going to be a galaxy, a nebula. Occasionally, quasars can get misclassified, but LSST is so big, I'm not really worried about that right now. And so the software, the dumb software we've had for decades, can go light, no light, and then go star, not star. And then the machine learning algorithms can look at all the not stars and go galaxy, planetary nebula, supernova remnant. I'm waiting to see how they differentiate those two.
Right. Asteroid, comet.
And then the things that it can't classify within a given percentage of probability, those can get kicked out, and some of those will be completely new objects we've never seen before. And once we've seen 100 of them, then we train the machine learning algorithm more. LST is going to have so much data that we're going to be able to train machine learning algorithms with a sufficiently large data set that we're going to be classifying things we don't even know about at this moment while we're recording this episode.
It's funny to think about that, that it's going to be recording just so much data about the sky that it will have a giant record of a class of object that we didn't even know exist. And some astronomer will look through it and go, huh, what's this? And then the algorithm will go, oh, you're interested in those things, huh? We didn't know what they are, but here's 10,000 more. The astronomer will be like, oh, thank you, computer. Thank you. This is my career now. Because it's going to be crazy. It's just going to be mental. And there's no way to do this without artificial intelligence, without machine learning, that is going to be grinding through these images one after the other and just identifying everything that's going on inside of them. Like, it would be hopeless.
But the other side of this is the citizen scientists or grad students or undergrads or whatever human beings are training those algorithms, they're just going to be casually looking through objects we've never seen before. And helping us figure out what they are as the wetware that goes to our software that allows our hardware to have its full potential.
Oh, yeah. So what do you think is the limit? I mean, again, you know, you run a citizen science organization getting citizens to help with astronomy. Where do you see the future going over the next couple of years as these computers continue making leaps and bounds and the data that they have access to is getting more complete and more machine learning friendly?
I don't see a limit, because over time, what's going to happen is those things that are very short-lived in the sky that are fairly rare are going to take years to track down and figure out. We're just starting to figure out what fast radio bursts are. Mm-hmm. We are just starting to figure out that there are these weird snakes that are visible to Meerkat in the center of our galaxy. And it's going to take, well, the entirety of the human future to see all the different things our universe has to offer us in statistically significant numbers.
I guess it's like the rarity, right? And maybe we're chasing Pokemons or something, or opening up magic cards. We've got all the common and the uncommons, now we're looking for the mythic rares, and they will be disgorged. But there'll be these weird objects, and there'll only be one every year. And astronomers will figure out that, oh, that's a situation where one star ate another star and then they were consumed by a third star.
Yeah.
And that's how you get that really weird flash, flash, flash that comes together. But by analyzing those, we will make these fundamental understandings about how the universe works. Oh, this might be why supermassive black holes got so big so early. Mm-hmm. This might be how the first stars were able to form. This might be what the universe is really populated with in between galaxies, that the one-offs and the weirdos tell us about the science as a whole, which is fantastic.
And the thing to keep in mind is 99% of the time that the software rejects something, it's because, like, you have a comet superimposed on top of a galaxy and the software is like, I don't know. Or you have two galaxies superimposed on each other, or it's going to be something where it's completely normal objects that are configured in a really weird way.
Yeah.
And human beings can look at that, and it's like those optical illusion photos that it's something normal and your brain initially interprets it as weird. You can figure it out. But that small fraction of the time is the reason you keep doing this, because you might find, well, Hanny's Warverp.
So don't worry, humans. You still have a role in the field of citizen science astronomy. But just don't be surprised if your time is spent teaching a computer to do your job so that you can find even more interesting projects to teach even newer computers to do that job as well. I like it. I think, yeah. You know, let's let the computers do the digging through petabytes of data to find
part.
That
information.
Yeah, the tedious work. Let's do the fun part. Awesome. Well, thank you, Pamela.
Thank you, Fraser. And now I have to say thank you to so many of you out there. This show is made possible by you and by the fact that you allow us to pay Rich, Nancy, Beth, Allie, all the folks behind the scenes to herd us like the cats we are and keep track of all the craziness that we sometimes introduce into scheduling and things like that. This week, I want to give a special thanks to Blixa the Cat, Dean, Claudia Mastriani, Connor, John Drake, Nyla, Bart Flaherty, Brian Kilby, Corrine Dimtruk, Tim Gorish, Arctic Fox, Lou Zealand, Lee Harborn, Mark Phillips, Kathleen Mattson, Bob the Boodle Cat, Chris Wheelwright, Jason Cordukas, Olivia Brain Zank, Ron Thorson, Papa 1062, Robert Hundy, Kim Barron, Vitali, Paul Esposito, Gordon Turner, Arthur Latz Hall, Frank Stewart, Ganesh Swamithan, Bob Zatsky, Ruben McCarthy, Jeff McDonald, Iggy Hammock, Rebecca Gold, Killian and David Parker, Scott Briggs, Roland Vormerdam. And if you too would like to be part of our amazing and vibrant Patreon community and potentially have me mispronounce your name, join us on patreon.com/astronomycast, and you can actually put in a pronunciation guide. All of you starting to do that.
Don't.
I see you.
Don't
I
do
love
it.
You.
Don't do it. I love it. All right.
So, thank you.
Thank you, everyone. We'll see you next week.
There are literally people putting in pronunciation guides, and they are my favorite humans. Bye-bye. Astronomy Cast is a joint product of Universe Today and the Planetary Science Institute. Astronomy Cast is released under a Creative Commons attribution license. So love it, share it, and remix it. But please, credit it to our hosts, Fraser Cain and Dr. Pamela Gay. You can get more information on today's show topic on our website, astronomycast.com. This episode was brought to you thanks to our generous patrons on Patreon. If you want to help keep this show going, please consider joining our community at patreon.com/astronomycast. Not only do you help us pay our producers a fair wage, you will also get special access to content right in your inbox and invites to online events. We are so grateful to all of you who have joined our Patreon community already. Anyways, keep looking up. This has been Astronomy Cast.